Welcome to the Fireside Podcast, presented by the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. I'm your host, Chase Maxwell. Twenty-one years ago, the Friends began a storytelling series for adults. What could be better than sitting by the fire, sipping a warm cup of coffee or cider, while listening to some of the best writers Minnesota has to offer? Over the years, the Fireside series has featured a great range of authors, from Kate DiCamillo to Jack Weatherford, Carol Bly to Jack Elhigh, making the winter just that much more bearable. The 2015 lineup is no exception. Well, there actually is one exception, and you're listening to it. For over 20 years, the Fireside series has drawn enthusiastic crowds to the beautiful, but small, Hamlin Midway Library. And this is one way we're celebrating that legacy, by broadcasting the entire season and reaching a larger audience. This episode features Minnesota Book Awards winner Marlon James reading from his new book, A Brief History of Seven Killings, described by the New York Times as sweeping, mythic, over the top, colossal, and dizzyingly complex. James's book uses the 1976 assassination attempt on Bob Marley as a springboard to explore Jamaican society and culture. Just a quick warning for those with children around, this episode contains explicit language and content. With that warning out of the way, sit back, cider in hand, and get ready to be transported.
Thanks for coming out, guys. Thanks for having me. I'm not having this here because I'm a jerk. I'm actually just timing myself. Because I hate those writers who go over. I was at a reading, and there was three of us and a writer who shall remain nameless. We were all supposed to read for, I think, 7 minutes, and she read for 37 minutes. So at the Q&A, one of the writers, every time she got asked a question, she would be, I really want to answer that, but since somebody hogged all the time with their reading and she kept going at it every question, you know, I could really get into that, but since somebody hogged all the time with their reading, I was like, you know what? I'll just behave myself. So I want to just get into it. A Brief History of Seven Killings, the very, very quick definition, the very, very quick, the Library of Congress definition. It's about a bunch of assassins who in 1976 tried to kill Bob Marley, which is an event which I'm so surprised so many people in the world didn't know about. But they tried to kill him in 1976, in December of 1976, before he was scheduled to do this peace concert. And right after the concert, he went on anyway. He went on to perform. Rita Marley's in the video. And a lot of people think she's wearing Rasta dress. She's actually in her hospital gown. Because Rita was shot in the head. Marley was shot in the chest. If he was exhaling, and if he was inhaling instead of exhaling, the bullet would have gone through his heart. And the men who tried to kill him, there's always been a mystery about them. And as a writer, I do think one of the things that really galvanizes me as a writer is to attempt to solve mysteries. And these men really, really fascinated me. But I also got very fascinated with other people involved. There are two things that really inspired this. One was a Gay Talese essay called Frank Sinatra Has a Cold. And if you've never read it, you should read it. It's probably the greatest piece of journalism in the 20th century. And it happened because of dire circumstances. Talese was in Miami, and Sinatra refused to talk to him. Every time he tried to get an interview, Sinatra's secretary would say, Mr. Sinatra has a cold. And Talese hit upon, whether it was inspiration or desperation, he hit upon this idea, let me just interview everybody around Sinatra. You know, who is changing his sheets? Who is picking the song list? Who's the band manager? And he built this entire portrait of Frank Sinatra totally through all the people around him. And it was one of the things that changed journalism. And I've always been fascinated with that type of story. Marley doesn't really appear in the book. In fact, he's not even named in the book. In the book, he's just called the singer. It's more about people who were in one way or another involved in the assassination attempt or got caught in it or just happened to be, in the case of one of the characters I will read, in the wrong place at the wrong time. And the consequences spill from 1976 to 1991. So the first character I'm going to read is actually, and I'm probably going to end with him as well, is actually a ghost. And his name is Sir Arthur George Jennings. And he begins the book, so I'm going to just start with him. Listen. Dead people never stop talking. Maybe because death is not death at all, just a detention after school. You know where you're coming from and you're always returning from it. You know where you're going, though you never seem to get there, and you're just dead. Dead. It sounds final, but it's a word missing an ing. The dead love dying under the living for three reasons. One, we're lying most of the time. Two, under the bed looks like the top of a coffin. But three, there is weight, human weight on top that you can slip into and make heavier. And you listen to the heart beat while you watch it pump and hear the nostrils hiss when the lungs press air and envy even the shortest breath. I have no memory of coffins. But the dead never stop talking and sometimes the living hear. This is what I wanted to say. When you're dead, speech is nothing but tangents and detours, and there's nothing to do but stray and wander a while. Well, that's what the others do. My point being that the expired learn from the expired, but that's tricky. I could listen to myself, still claiming to anybody that would hear that I didn't fall. I was pushed over the balcony at the Sunset Beach Hotel in Montego Bay. And I could say, shut your trap, Artie Jennings, because every morning I wake up having to put my pumpkin smash head back together. And even as I talk now, I can hear how I sounded then. Can you dig it? Dingle duties, meaning the afterlife is just not a happening scene, just not a groovy shindig, daddy-o. They could never dig it, and there's nothing to do but wait for the man that killed me. But he won't die. He gets older and older, and trades out wives for younger and younger, and breeding a whole brood of slow-witted boys and running the country into the ground. Nobody falls that way without being pushed. I know. And I know how it feels and looks, a body that falls, fighting air all the way down, grabbing onto clumps of nothing and begging once, just goddamn once, Jesus, you sniveling son of a mongrel bitch, just once that air gives a grip. And you land in a ditch 5 feet deep, or a marble tile floor 16 feet down, still fighting with the floor when the floor rises up and smashes into you because it got tired of waiting for blood. And we're still dead, but we wake up. Me, a crushed spider, him, a burned cockroach. I have no memory of coffins. Listen. Living people wait and see because they fool themselves that they have time. Dead people see and wait. I once asked my Sunday school teacher, if heaven is the place of eternal life and hell is the opposite of heaven, what does that make hell? A place for dirty little red boys like you, she said. She's still alive. I see her at the eventide old folks home, getting too old and too stupid, not knowing her name, and talking in so soft a rasp that nobody can hear that she's scared of nightfall, because that's when the rats come for her good toes. I see more than that. Look hard enough, or maybe just to the left, and you see a country the same as I left it. It never changes, and whenever I'm around people, they are exactly as I left them, age making no difference. This is a story of seven killings, of boys who meant nothing to a world still spinning, but each of them, as they pass me by, carry the sweet stink scent of the man that killed me. So from 1976, I'm making a huge jump to 1985. And this is another character who appears in the novel. Her name is Dorcas Palmer. And she's in the Bronx. This is the Bronx, 1985, which is not like the Bronx now. And what you should know about this scene, with her is a very rich, older man, Mr. Calters, from Fifth Avenue. Why is he in the Bronx? You're going to have to find out. What else you need to know about Dorcas Palmer is her name is not Dorcas Palmer. So This is them in the Bronx. Now it's too dark to use "it's getting dark" as an excuse for him to leave. Another Dorcas Palmer, a smarter one, would be wondering how the hell the evening ended up with a man in her apartment. Then again, who gives a rass? A man can show up in a woman's apartment without wondering what the neighbors think. And besides, I don't know my neighbors. But if he thinks this night is going to end up like some French comedy, with mean bed, sheets up to my tits, and him with a contented smile as he smokes a cigarette, he just made one sad mistake. He's watching the skyline from my window. Here I thought I had a shitty view. I know this part. I watch Dynasty. I should ask him if he would like a drink. Except all I have is some cheap vodka, because liquor never stopped being bitter, and some pineapple juice that I just can't say for sure if it isn't spoiled. And isn't offering a drink just code for "would you like to have me now?" Which isn't going to happen, even though he really does look like Lyle Waggoner, and I heard Lyle pose for Playgirl. The sad thing is, I really do want to slip into something more comfortable. All this fucking tweed on a summer day is itching the rass out of me. And my feet have a strict five-hour high heels limit before they start to scream, "Bitch, what are you trying to do, kill us?" I chuckle too loud, and he turns around and looks at me. A smile from a man is a down payment, Dorcas Palmer. Don't sell him nothing. I know I promised not to say anything about going home, I say. So don't. You have any idea how many people I know that can't keep a promise? Sounds like rich people problems. Sorry, you heard me. I swear part of the reason why I can't leave, can't, is that you just seem to get bolder by the hour. Who knows what you'll be by 10? I'm not really sure that is a compliment. Me neither, actually. We'll just have to wait until 10 then. I wanted to say something about the nerve of this man to move into my space, encroach on my time, and assume I have nothing better to do. And then he says, "But then again, you must have something better to do than humor an old man." I've said you're not old 2 times already. Maybe you should fish for a new compliment. He laughs. The sun's gone. Got anything to drink around here? Vodka, some pineapple juice, and I don't know. Got ice? I'm sure I can work up some. So you have shit to drink then? I'll have a vodka and some pineapple juice or whatever is in the fridge. What, your hand sick? Vodka and clean glasses are both on the counter. He looks at me, nods, and laughs. Fucking love this, he says. I'm starting to wonder if this is the movie where the sassy black maid gives the old patrician a reason to live again. Yet still, there's no proof that this man is in any way old, or needs anybody's help for that matter. Your son and daughter must be worried by now. Maybe. There's club soda in the fridge. Can I use that? Yes. And it might be time to throw out that slice of pizza. And that half box of ramen. Thank you. Any other suggestions for my fridge? I'd get rid of that half-eaten burger, too. And no self-respecting person should ever be caught drinking Coors. I wasn't actually expecting suggestions for my fridge. Then why ask? You want a vodka soda with a hint of pineapple? Sure. Coming up, I watched the man take over my kitchen. Can't remember when I bought lime, and it must have been recently because he's using it. He tried 3 times to cut with my knife before he pulls out another and strikes them against each other like he's sword fighting himself. Then he chops up the lime. He looks at my glasses on the counter and nods in what looks like pity. I don't remember saving 2 salsa bottles, but he finds them. Chop, crush, squeeze, stir. Yes, it is something to watch a man work. I don't know if I've ever seen a man in the kitchen who wasn't on TV. He walks over with both bottles and hands one to me. Well, is it any good? It's very good. Well, thanks for the enthusiasm. It's wonderful, really. He sits down in the armchair that I had my neighbor help carry up from the street. The neighbor that I have not spoken to since. I hope it doesn't smell. He's sipping slow, as if he doesn't want the drink to end, and by extension, this day. Aren't you itching in that skirt? I mean, it's summer. I'm not taking off my skirt. Don't think I asked you to. You're wondering how much of a mistake you made inviting me over. No. So a yes then. I don't double talk. Good. It's weird to think, but the only way I can describe how he sits is strong. And notice it at his home and on the subway as well, him rejecting all those chairs inviting him to slump and sitting straight with his back arched. Must be from his days in the military. Shouldn't the police be looking for you by now? Can't file a missing persons report until it's been 24 hours. How soon can you file a kidnapping? I'm a little too big to be kidnapped, don't you think? Thought size didn't matter. Keep this up or you might be having as much fun as me. Don't you have any music? You want to hear what the happening kids are listening to these days? Yes, actually. What's the latest? That Good Times is quite good, isn't it? Quite good. Boy, you've been out of it. I get up and put a record on. Well, the one on top of the stack. Funny, back in Jamaica, records were what my father listened to. And it was always dreary instrumental stuff like Billy Vaughan La Paloma and stuff from the James Last Orchestra. 1985, and I must be the only person to have one of those all-in-one stereo cabinets, at least one named Telefunken. I still remember the one time my mother brought home a record. It was just a 45 from Millie Jackson called If You're Not Back in Love by Monday. But I think she waited until we were all out before she would play it. Church organs? Good gracious, are you playing church music? No, that's a preacher, and he's talking about the afterworld, and that is most definitely organs. Will you shut up and listen? He sits back down, just as Prince says, in this life, you're on your own. Oh my God, I do quite like this. He stands back up, snapping his fingers, nodding his head. I wonder if he was a teenager during Elvis and what he thought of the Beatles. I want to ask him if he likes rock and roll, but the question seems silly for a man finger snapping and tapping like Bill Cosby just taught him jive. Let's go crazy. Let's get nuts, he says. I feel guilty for not dancing, so I get up and dance. And then I do something I never, ever, ever do. Doctor, everything will be all right. Makes everything go wrong. I grab the comb on the kitchen counter, and it's a microphone for three more woo-hoo-hoos. And then the guitar solo comes, and at first I think he's having a heart attack, but he's actually miming the guitar solo. I jump and yell, go crazy, and the song stretches out the moment so long. I mean, I've listened to this song 10 million times, but it's never been this long, until it just collapses and so do we. I'm on the floor, he's on the couch. He jumps right back on up when Take Me With You comes on, but I'm still on the floor panting and laughing. That may be the most fun I've had since the Beatles came on Ed Sullivan. Is what with you people and the Beatles? They're only the greatest rock band of all time. That last client had us standing outside John Lennon's hotel all night that night. Whatever for? Was he recording with Paul? What? I'm not sure that's funny. He walks over to the stereo and picks up the album jacket. So who's a homely looking dyke on the bike? That's Prince. Prince who? Just Prince. The mustache wasn't a giveaway? Well, my second thought was that this was the hottest bearded lady ever. He has a movie out named Purple Rain. Purple is not Prince, not Jimmy. I should probably take it off. He gets a little explicit. Sweetie, I'm the only white man in five boroughs who actually owns Blo-Fi Records. This Prince doesn't scare me. Sorry for calling you, sweetie. I wanted to tell him that I didn't mind and that it's still the first time anybody, certainly any man, has called me anything nice in a while. But I looked out the window at the skyline turning on the lights. Who's the girl on the cover? Apollonia. She's supposed to be his girlfriend in real life. So he's not gay then? You must be hungry. You didn't eat any of that pizza at your house. I am, kinda. What you got? Nachos and ramen. Good Lord, not together. You prefer we call chicken McNuggets? Milady Duff has a point. I put the kettle on for the noodles, which means time just sitting listening to the rest of the album. So where are you from exactly? What? Where are you? Can you turn that off? It's not like Elvis is leaving the building. Where are you from? Eat your noodles. Kingston. You already said that. A place named Havendale. Is that in a city? The suburbs. Like the Midwest? No, like Queens. Ghastly. Why did you leave? It was just time to go. Just like that? Was it Michael Manley and all that communist hoo-ha that was going on? I see you're very informed about the Cold War. Sweetie, I grew up in the 50s. I was being sarcastic. I know. One of the things that I thought was interesting is Americans in Jamaica and Jamaicans in America. So Alex Alex Pierce is a journalist from Rolling Stone, and he's here to cover the peace concert, but he just suspects something deeper is going on in Jamaica. He just can't quite put his finger on what it is. So he's trying to play, he tells everybody he's a journalist, but he actually just covers the gossip section in Rolling Stone. So he's a person sent down to find out if Mick Jagger came to Jamaica alone or if he came with his girlfriend or one of those many black women he seems to find all over the place. So he's trying to pose as a serious journalist. Gig like this got its own juice. I'm in Kingston, somewhere between Studio One and Black Ark, thinking there must be a reason why hippies have such a hard-on for this scene. I mean, a poor boy can't do nothing but sing in a rock and roll band. A rich boy, on the other hand, can stop cutting his hair, calling himself a hippie along with some hairy armpit chicks, confuse having the means to tune in and drop out with the conviction to do it, and call himself a Rastafarian. Then he goes off to St. Bart's, or Maui, or Negril, or Port Maria, sticking it to the man between rum punches. I always hated hippies. Worse, now you have rich bitch Jamaicans imitating hippies, imitating Rastas. What the fuck? But hey, it's Jamaica. At least everybody should be pumping some Big Youth and Jimmy Cliff. And yet when I get here, first time in a year, the only thing playing on the radio was more, more, more. How do you like it? How do you like it? And I'm thinking, this rep is bogus. I flip to another station, and it's Ma Baker, She Knew How to Die. Switch to FM radio, and it's Fly Robin Fly, up to the sky. I ask this busboy at the hotel, so where do I hear some Mighty Diamonds or Dillinger? He looks at me like I just asked to suck him off, and that not every Jamaican sells the Cali weed, sir. Even ABBA gets more play than reggae here. If I hear Dancing Queen one more time, I can feel myself turning fag. I'm at Skyline, the hotel with a commanding view of the hotel in front of me. In Kingston, you go down the street, there's a black guy and a white guy and lots of mixed guys, and they're all at the same hotel or at the singer's house. Even on TV, the weather guy is black. You see black people all the time in the States, right? But you don't really see them, certainly not in reading the news. You hear them on the radio all the time, but once a song is over, they vanish. They're on TV, but only when somebody just acted like a jive turkey or somebody made them say dynamite. Jamaica is different. A Jamaican is on TV. A white woman just won Miss World, but she's from here. She said that the singer is her boyfriend, and she can't wait to go back home to be with him. No shit. Some stone foxes live in this city, and they can all dance. Out the window, even the traffic has music to it. That and people telling people about them bumper clat. In the resorts, the Americans say bumper clat and think they're cooler because they got their head braided by a girl Friday. Not from the movie. This is some Robinson Crusoe black personal slave shit, no kidding. They looked at me weird when I dropped my drink the first time I heard it. People let it all hang out here. They move with a kind of swag, but nobody forgets their place. And if you talk enough to enough people in the hotel, you get the white tone. People being polite to a fault because that's how they were trained to talk to you. And because it's all about race, it fucks up all the time. One time, this black guy asked for a busboy to take his bags, and the boy just walked off. Guy started shouting that this is some slavery-loving Uncle Tom bullshit right here, for him to realize he was American. And even then, the boy asked to see his room key. Still, it's Jamaica, and this place is kinda ace. Sergi Gainsbourg, that ugly French dude, who keeps making cheesy records and scoring hot chicks, has a story. So he comes to Jamaica because he's heir to Doozy Reggae, and motherfuckers at the studio just laugh him off, right? Like, who the bumba clout is like a skinny French you think he is? Serge says, but I am the biggest pop singer. They say, we don't know you. The only bumba clout French song we know is Je T'aime. Serge says, Je T'aime, that is me. Ginsberg was a god after that. So I'm at Studio One and asked for one of the men here if he could get me a cup of coffee. Black, no cream. And he says, what, your hand sick? Get it your bumba clout self. Classic, man. I'm supposed to be on Mick Jagger's tail. But nobody's going to call Black and Blue a misunderstood masterpiece. Not in 10 years, not in 20. And I said so in print. Fuck him and Keith anyway. And fuck Rolling Stone gossip bullshit. I'm this close to getting a skinny on something big. Armageddon time, square biz. The busiest, most vital music scene in the world is about to blow up and not on the charts. The singer, he's up to something, and it's not just a peace concert. It took putting in a few years uptown and downtown and some convincing to prove to people that I wasn't some stupid white boy waiting for the limbo party for people to start talking to me. That Kingston sissy at the front desk doesn't even know who Don Drummond is, but he keeps telling me that everything I need is in New Kingston. There's this too. Jamaicans, not the ones who work at the hotel, but brown and white men who are always drinking rum at the restaurant and who, when they see my camera, first ask if I'm from Life magazine, then tell me where not to go. Go where they go and you end up at the Ligany Club where it's disco duck and boring rich bitches who just finished tennis and want to ball. I tell them I'm bailing for the Turntable Club and they look at me and wonder. Worse when I don't bother asking for directions because I would know they wouldn't know. I asked the concierge just a few hours ago, where's the jam session? He says, and I quote and kid thee not, sir, why you want to mingle with them element of society? I was this close to saying, dude, suck a dick already. It's cool. But this story, it's something. I'm in a taxi heading to the hotel and the taxi driver asks me if I bet on horses. I'm not a betting man, but he is. And who did he see at the tracks a couple weeks ago? The singer. He was with two guys, one of them calling himself Papalo. I did some checking on this Papalo. Racketeering, extortion, 5 counts of murder, only one reaching trial, acquitted. Runs a shantytown called Copenhagen City. So here's a singer, along with two hoods from a political party he's supposed to not support, and they're chummy together like they're old school pals. The next few days, he's seen hanging out with Shatter Sheriff, the godfather of the 8 lanes, controlled by the other party, the other side. 2 top goons in 1 week. 2 men who control the fighting halves of downtown Kingston. Maybe he's just a peacemaker. I mean, he's just a singer. The thing is, I'm catching a drift that nobody's ever just anything in Jamaica. Something is cooking, and I already smell it. Did I mention there's an election in 2 weeks? All right, so one-ish more. After the assassination attempt on Marley fails, the speculation is that they would try again. And one of the main characters in this book is a character, his name is Josie Wales. And he's sort of the reigning, he starts out second in command at the beginning of the book. He ends the such an important number one, such an important Don, that every new CIA attaché who comes to Jamaica has to meet him. That's how important he becomes. But this is before that. This is 1976. This is the day after Marley's concert, and he's now trying to go away, get away to Miami, to Bahamas. But Josie Wales knows, and knows the flight he's going to be on. December 1976, the singer just threw a concert in the park, and I'm wasting time at Jamintel Communications because I need to make an international phone call to only to hear Dr. Love and some idiot cursing out in Spanish, but not Cuban Spanish, so I didn't understand most of it, but I know he was mad. And I'm thinking, who this man think him is if I don't know what hijo de puta means? What do you think? I was going to the start cry and say, I'm so sorry, boss man. Next time I'll do better, I promise. Was about to tell this maricon about his bomber clad when Dr. Love said to me, just finish the job, muchacho, just finish it. So the Jamaican Syrian, the Cuban, and the Colombian all want a body, yet none of them realize that I gave them something better than a body. Same week, Peter Nasser, the politician, calls me with, what the bomber clad wrong with you ghetto people? This is not the first time I hear you with you people. I didn't say you people, I said you ghetto people. What wrong with you? Nine man? Eight. Eight man storm into OK Corral with what, 14 guns? And you can't even shoot one man? My man can shoot straight. How you manage being the first man in history to shoot somebody in the head and not kill them? Answer that, master. I don't know who you mean by you. Are you so fucking fool you think phone can't tap? What this look like, a spy movie? Who the rats would want to tap you? Even so, I don't know who you mean by you, but I'm sure him, whoever he is, didn't aim for anybody's head. He, whoever him is, didn't aim for nothing at all but wall and sky. Nah, Busha, this kind of slackness and poppy show only happened in comedy. Imagine, hundreds of bullets and you couldn't take out one man? A fucking machine gun? How hard can it be to shoot? I thought Lewis taught you people how to deal with these things. I don't know no Lewis, and I sure don't know no you people. Don't draw my tongue, Josie Wales. I told him, you know, don't make sense trying to teach ghetto niggas anything. They'll just take any kind of intelligence. They'll bound to screw it up. My blind grandmother could hit a target better than you. All eight of you. I don't know why I even bother calling you. I don't know why either, since none of those people you're talking about live here. Why am I even running up my phone, Billy? Tell me. I don't know why, Busha. What? You know who you're talking to? You know who you're... I hang up the phone. It's a bit of a thing when you realize that though you're the only one who didn't go to a high school, you're the only man in the room with any sense. I really wanted to educate this ignorant, bad-chatting Syrian shithouse that it's bad enough that plenty man and woman want the singer off as a prophet, but kill him and the man graduate to martyr. This way the whole world know that, guess what? This prophet is just a man like any other man. He can get shot like any other man, and like any other man in this country, not even he safe. I shoot that man off the pedestal and he fall back down to man size. I didn't tell Peter Nasser any of that. I said to Dr. Love, who also called me that night, that I'd done dealing with proving things to people from 1966. And if they really think that it's prep school where they feel they must test and test, then Medellin can go right back to using those batty boys in Bahamas. But then, to use the rest of their own words, I get hit with another reasoning. If the singer did turn into a martyr, it would be a big problem for sure, but it would be their problem, not mine. Peter Nasser would be so busy shitting himself trying to kill a legend that he won't have time to bother me with his foolishness, because truth be told, both he and I know that I long past the days when politicians say jump and I say how high. So I decided to let my mind work on this new reasoning. December 8, 1976, news come that he and everybody survive. Only the manager was still in the hospital, so me and my Pavarotti, my assistant, drive down to 56 Hope Road, expecting the police. Police don't mean nothing. All you need is one shot. Besides, I make one phone call and they would disappear in 60 seconds, except nobody was there. It was a ghost town. Empty driveway, darkness, and not a single police. I laugh and Pavarotti look at me. I make a phone call. Where the bird flying to? Bridging, where you call me for? I don't like repeating questions, you know. He gone. They leave the manager at the hospital and take him up the White Man Hill. Police? One in the car with him, four more back at the place. 12 tribes on watch all over the hill. And a white boy. A white boy? A white boy with a camera. Nobody know where he come from, but he say he's with the film crew. Anyway, me don't talk. No, you don't talk yet, Inspector. Me don't sing this song. No, Canary, you're just a start. Not even Jesus getting up that hill tonight. What about the concert? Full escort to and from. The next day, I don't know, talk. The next day he's supposed to fly out. They have him on a private jet. When? 5:30 or 6, morning or evening? What you think? To where? Nobody know. So a jet going take off and nobody know where it going. Boss, you think I get a man for idiot? Mister, nobody know. Not even the commissioner of police know. He don't even know that the singer planned to fly out. So it's a top secret? More secret than the color of the queen panty. We only know because our man in the car with him and him pretending that him gone to sleep. Him white manager tell him up the hill as soon as he done with the concert. Oh, so he going to the concert? No, but nothing not official. Them just putting things in place just in case. Anyway, the manager say that as soon as the concert done, him setting up a plane for him at the airport, but early, before the airport even open. Norman Manley Airport or Tinson Pen? Manley. Oh, so I'm going overseas. You can radio the police up the hill? Yeah, man, but why would I want to radio your police up the hill? Radio them right now. 6 a.m, and the airport look like the first reel of a cowboy movie. Only thing missing is Whistling Wind and Tumbleweed. Pink sky. Me and Tony Pavarotti waiting in the stairway leading up to the waving gallery. Somebody thought it was a good idea making this wall like some checker pattern with an open space to stick a rifle through. Check pattern shadows leave we in the dark. Pavarotti shifting and moving. He wasn't feeling for this angle at all. But the plane was already on the runway. Pavarotti quiet, his right hand gripping the trigger, his left eye in the rifle lens. Way to the end of the runway, two jeeps hang back lazy. Jamaica Defense Force, with 4 or 5 soldiers positioned behind them, 2 with binoculars. See that I saw them from the second I went out to the waving gallery. Seeing soldiers on the lookout made me think the singer coming down from the White Man Hill. The look on his face when he wake up and see no police. He probably sent 2 or 3 Rasta brethren ahead to see if the road's safe. What he and his right-hand man was coming down the hill alone, which mean him and his right-hand man was coming down the hill alone. With no soldier watching through binoculars, you can always assume 1 or 2 things about the police. 1, make a deposit to a bank account or a back pocket and anything can happen. And 2, they always come cheap. But with soldiers, you never know. They hang back, standing, watching maybe, but just as likely they're just waiting. Maybe you should take him out before the soldier drive over. Pavarotti nods. 6:02. Everybody but the sun waiting on the singer. For a second, it feels like a parade, like that grainy newsreel that come on TV every November about Kennedy in Dallas. Everybody waiting on the singer, not just me, not just the soldiers, not just Tony Pavarotti or the plane, but Peter Nasser, Dr. Love, and a phone number for the Medellin cartel that I never use myself. But then I wonder, everybody waiting to see his next move or mine? Who's the real dancing monkey in this episode? Who people watching to see the next move? And if people said jump and you managed to jump high, do they stop telling you to jump or disrespect you forever because you didn't act like a man and say, screw you, bad man, don't jump for nobody? The problem with proving something is that instead of leaving you alone, people never stop giving you new things to prove. Harder things, bullshit things, until it become a TV comedy or just a joke. Tony Pavarotti tapped my shoulder. He's here. He and another Rasta walking to the plane. Nothing moved but the dust they kick up. The airport is still empty and not waking up until 7. They look around while walking, moving slow, stopping 1 second then moving again. The singer looked to the plane, scanning left and right, with the other Rasta walking backwards, making sure nobody behind them. Both of them see the army jeep and stop. The singer look at the jeep and look at the plane. Nobody move. Tony Pavarotti turning the gun to aim, following them. His fingers slip around the trigger. The singer looking at the soldiers and says something to the Rasta. They start moving again slower, stopping right in front of the plane. Maybe they're waiting for somebody to come out. I remember that Tony Pavarotti don't need orders from me. I hear a click. Stop. Pavarotti look at me and look at the 2 of them running to the plane now. No bother with it. They run to the plane and have to close the door themselves. When I get 2 phone calls the next day, I cut both short with the same line. You want him dead so much, you kill him.
we finally reached the best part of the Fireside series, the Q&A with the author and our dedicated audience. It's a chance to go beyond the book, connecting readers and writers on a deeper level. To make it easier for you, the listener, I've transcribed the questions and will read them. The first question is about the future of A Brief History on the big screen. Would Marlon James like to see the book adapted for film or television?
I'd probably want more of a TV series, I guess, because it's such a long book. And I like getting steady checks. I just want Idris Elba. Idris Elba. Just, I don't care anybody else. Give me a white Bob Marley, whatever. I just want Idris Elba. That's it.
The next question is about Peter Tosh, an important figure in 1970s Jamaica, but not a character included in James' novel. For those unfamiliar with Peter Tosh, he was a Jamaican reggae musician and a core member of the Wailers, along with Bob Marley, in the 60s and 70s.
Peter Tosh and Bob Marley had a very contentious relationship from the get-go. You know, they, in a lot of ways, kind of grew up together. Peter Tosh wasn't really involved in the peace concert, in the first peace concert. He was involved in the second. And he's always had a very sort of troubling, tormented history. The one of the reasons why he didn't want to do the peace concert is just a few weeks ago he was beaten and abused by the police. There are things Marley could do that Tosh couldn't do. In 1978, Marley is coming in and customs delaying him, and he just gets so annoyed he just grabs his bag and walks out. Because what are you gonna do? Stop Bob Marley? Yes. Tosh wasn't that lucky. There's a very sort of eerie moment in 78 when Marley asks Peter Tosh to do the second peace concert, and Peter Tosh says, "I'm not doing it because everybody who go up on that stage will die." And nearly everybody who went up on that stage has died. A lot of them violently, including Peter Tosh, who was killed later on. But he wasn't so much involved in the Marley story at this point. At this point, Peter Tosh was pretty much Marley's rival. One of the reasons why Mick Jagger and Keith Richards keep reappearing in the book is that at this point they were in Jamaica all the time. They both still have houses there. And Peter Tosh was their great big signing. And he was a great, they were best friends for years. I give you some Keith Richards gossip. So Keith Richards flies back to Jamaica and he wants his house back because Peter Tosh has been living in there for 4 years. And he says, "Peter, I want my house." And Tosh says, "If you show up, I will kill you." And Keith Richards say, "With what? The gun that I had to teach you how to shoot? Get out of my fucking house." So Keith Richards ends up reading as the one foreigner who has ever scared a Jamaican. So he has this sort of uncommon cool in Jamaica. Keith Richards knows stuff about Jamaica that most Jamaicans don't know about, including Obia, witchcraft and all of that. But yeah, that's how Peter Tosh sort of plays in the story. He doesn't really appear much in this book. The one part he appears is a second peace concert when he gives this. The real thing is something to behold. It was like a 10-minute rant, which I couldn't put all in its entirety, so I just put a little bit in there. But he was always, it's funny, because in a lot of ways, even though he always sung baritone, he actually has a nicer falsetto than Bob. But he sort of rarely used it.
Next up, an audience member asked about the role of an author in solving mysteries for the reader, and asked Marlon James if he ever finds himself creating mysteries in his novels, but never solving them.
I'm a big believer in not tying up every end, because life isn't like that. When I came here, the thing I could never get past is this thing people keep talking about, closure. I would love closure. I'm like, no, you don't get closure. You get a question sign for the rest of your life. That's just how it is. I do think that in that sense, some things are left unresolved. My first novel ends with a woman out of nowhere just raising her hands, showing a cryptic sign. And everybody keeps asking me, what does that mean? What happened? I'm like, if I knew, I would have written it. So I think there is something to a story. I also remember one of my most vivid memories of reading is the sort of afterlife a story gave you, especially if you fell in love with the characters. You just don't want to say goodbye. And nowadays we do that by just respond to that by writing fan fiction, which tends to be about Harry Potter having gay sex. I have no idea what that's about. I'll leave it alone. Let the kids do what they want. But the characters live on because of that sort of unfinishedness, that sort of mystery. And sometimes you have to sort of force yourself not to tie everything up, because life really isn't like that.
The next question is about the research behind the book. Did Marlon James ever contact the Marley family when he was writing the book?
Not really. Largely because it's not really a novel about Marley that much. It's the assassination attempt is a trigger, the sort of touch point that starts it off. But it really is a lot about Jamaicans living through the 70s and Jamaicans living in the America of the 80s. It's about the rise of the drug culture in the 80s. There's a lot of it on just the explosion of crack and the fall of you know, sort of the literal fall of Brooklyn in the early 80s, going back to what happened in the early 90s. So it's the book is from 76 to 91. By 81, Marley's dead. So he doesn't figure that much in it. Other than that, I've really heard from the family. The book is nice to Marley. It's not nice to anybody else. But he comes off pretty well. You know, he comes off pretty well in it. There are things about Marley that's really remarkable. The only other person I can think of is maybe Fela, and Fela didn't have as much of wide an appeal. But Marley was a pop singer essentially. And you talk about, imagine a Bob Dylan where every time he's creating, there are at least four people on the road trying to kill you. Another set of people, the ruler of the country want you in his back pocket. The ruler of the opposition wants you in his back pocket. They're both at your house right now, every day. So the stakes, I can't think of anybody else in pop music for whom the stakes are always so high all the time. And, still put out one album, two albums a year, and tour everywhere. At one point, by 1979, he was already suffering from cancer. By 1979, it was pretty much inoperable. And he's still, giving it all the time. So it was a pretty, he was a really remarkable guy. The thing about Marley is, once you introduce Marley in anything, he will take over. So I kind of had to leave him as a singer, he didn't take over the damn book.
Next up, what has the reaction been like in Jamaica to A Brief History of Seven Killings?
I have no idea. It's so long that they haven't finished reading it yet. My reaction is probably the reaction to all the other books I've written. In Jamaica, the Edwidge Danticat has a great essay called "Create Dangerously," where she talks about the kind of flack she gets back in Haiti, because they think her, why are your women always brutalized? Why are the men always monsters? Why paint this horrible picture of Haitians and of black people? Blah blah blah. And she was like, I always thought my characters only owed a duty to themselves. That they don't answer to anybody or to anybody's idea of what should be the image of the country. So there's always that debate, and that debate still goes on. I'm not necessarily the Jamaican art scene's idea of a respectable author. There have been protests before. One reading because of some swearing, because we have swearing is actually an offense in Jamaica. You're supposed to be arrested. So there was a newspaper article that if musicians are arrested for swearing, why wasn't Marlon James? So I'm like, so I stay over this side of the pond for a little bit. But we'll see.
And now another research question. How did Marlon James go about researching the Jamaica of the 1970s and the Bronx in the 1980s?
Um, one, hiring tons of researchers. Thank God for students. they do it for credit. But you, a lot of it was going back, you have to go back to primary sources, news reports, primary sources being just fanning every person you know who was alive in the 70s and badger them. A lot of the second half of the story, the behind, when Bob Marley came back in 78, for example, for that peace concert, it was actually just part of a bigger plan. And I didn't know about that until I started to hang around some people from that time. And they're like, dude, the concert was just for show. What? And then he told me what was really going on, which you will have to read the book to find out. Well, I found that from just talking to people, asking people. You know, I lived in the 70s when I was a kid. So for the 70s, it was a world of wonder for me. 70s was, where's the next cookie? Do we have to wait a week for Starsky and Hutch? So there was that, but also reading all the sources, it also means reading all the books on Jamaica. And one of the things that I realized reading all these books on Jamaica, the Bob Marley biographies, stories about Jamaican politics, Jamaican gun culture, is how much they get wrong. And knowing they probably know no Jamaican is ever going to read this book. So nobody's ever going to call them out on it. Then we have me. But but reading that, sometimes I'd even read old like statistics and tax records and lots of old newspapers. Newspapers can be really interesting, not for the facts they give you because those are useless, but it's very interesting seeing the Cold War language and the Cold War biases and so on. And so that was almost in a way unintentionally helpful. Also reading tons of books. One of the running threads in the book is a kind of 70s history of the CIA. Largely because a lot of the people in Jamaica are the Latin America and Congo boys. A lot of the names I knew already. Most of which have changed because they will sue you. And yeah, but there was tons of research. I am a research addict. Even with assistance, I was still do a lot because it's such a great way to not write. And believe it or not, I actually love to not write. Any reason to procrastinate, I'll take it. And research is a terrible one.
The next question is about violence and a brief history of seven killings. How does Marlon James go about writing violent scenes?
Yeah, violence can be tricky. Explicitness in general can be tricky. It's the same challenge when you're writing sex, I think. On one hand, there is a very sort of tasteful violence that I find very false. I've said this in another interview. If you read a story about violence or abuse and you are touched, you're reading the wrong story. You're supposed to be horrified. Violence is violent. Sex also is erotic and sexy. It's a very tricky line, though, because you have to, especially for someone like me who writes violence an awful lot, you have to not slide over into a pornography. Because the response to relentless violence is not continued horror, you just get numb to it. And you get insensitive to it. And it's a dangerous thing to get insensitive to because it's still people brutalizing people. You should never be insensitive to it. So the writer, and different people have different standards for that. In my books, I do believe violence should be violent, but I don't think, at least I hope, I don't go to the point where it's unreadable. I've read unreadable books so that you guys wouldn't have to. And part of the things that made them unreadable is that there becomes a sort of glorification of it, which is not the same as being explicit. You can be explicit with violence. You can be explicit with sex. Susanna Moore writes a type of book that Gone Girl will never be. You know, this sort of sexual, edgy, relentless, seriously dangerous fiction. She has a fantastic novel called In the Cut, which I usually steer to anybody who's ever going to the tricky territory of writing the sexual thriller. So just read that book, then realize you can't do it. But you have to, you're on the edge of a knife. It's always tricky, it's always uncomfortable. You always run a risk of failure. You're gonna fail a couple times. Because I have. There are scenes I've written in older books that I cringe at now. And I knew it was because of, it was a young writer's desire to shock. And that can, that, and that again is also, yeah, bad writing. It's, but I think you have to risk it though. Same thing with sex, and same thing with not just extreme violence, but extreme joy. How do you write extreme happiness in a book without it coming across as maudlin and sentimental? How do you write love in a book? It's actually the same, it's the same challenge. You'd be surprised, a kiss is as hard to write as a stabbing. And I will go down in infamy for saying that live on stage. But it's the same rules. Where does subtlety, where does simplicity, where does economy enter into it? And are we, and are people still getting the effect that you want a scene to pull across?
The second to last question. How long did it take Marlon James to write the book?
Yeah, it's funny, because the last book I wrote, I did write from basically beginning to end. How it's read is pretty much how I wrote it. The first, you know what, I'm gonna look for it, hopefully we have time. The first page, the first thing I ever wrote in this book, I'll tell you where it appears, because it's hilarious. The very first page that I wrote, the very first paragraph that I ever wrote in this book is now on page 458. That's the very first thing I ever wrote. Because this book had such a crazy genesis. I wasn't trying to write it linear. I was trying to just go with who I fell in love with first. And the first character I wrote was actually this gay Chicago hitman stranded in Miami, who just is there to kill a Jamaican. He has no idea why or what or who, and he doesn't care. But that's an idea of just how crazy the genesis of this was. I didn't set out to write a novel first. I actually set out to write a novella. I also didn't intend to write so many characters. What happened was I kept starting these single-person novels, and they just would go nowhere. And one day I had dinner with a friend of mine, Rachel, who's no longer with us, sadly. And Rachel was a person who said to me, why do you think it's one person's story? Because I kept saying, I have no idea whose story this is. And she was like, well, why do you think this is one person's story? When last have you read As I Lay Dying? And I went back and read that, and that was like the eureka moment, that it wasn't one person's story. It was all these tons of stories, all these people in first person telling the story, these different voices. I really like difficult work. I like hard work, and I like books that feel impossible when I start. And this felt totally ridiculous when I was doing it, which for me is usually a good sign. And that's how it happened. It took 4 years to write. Largely, again, because it probably was the first novel where I had no idea where it was going. Actually, that's not true. I had a very narrow idea. I thought it's going to be 1976. It's going to be about the assassination attempt. And it's going to just keep going over and over and recycling that. The idea that it would go into the 80s and in the 90s. 4 years before I finished this book, I had no idea. One of the things that I like doing with novels, well, recently and with stories, is I like throwing stories to characters. It may be why I write in first person a lot. And when you throw stories to characters, you've sort of given them permission to become humans. And when you do that, they go in all sorts of directions. Characters surprise you, they disappoint you, they make horrible choices. And just sort of leaving it to become organic in that way, and the novel just sort of spooled. The novel, and I, you know, even the ending I had doubts about, because the novel doesn't really end, it just kind of stops. And I for months I kept writing these endings. I'm like, I need something big and profound. Somebody walking off in a sunset, something. And I was like, no, I think this is the end of it. This is where it ends. But it took 4 years. I wrote most of it. If there's a cafe in this city, I wrote there.
And finally, a question about Marlon James's writing schedule. Does he have a regular schedule? And how long does it often take for him to complete his novels?
It depends on the book. For the book before this, Book of Night Woman, I'd get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and write till 9. Also because I was at a job that started at 9. I did that. This one, I pretty much wrote little later, usually from like, say, 7 in the morning to around 2 in the afternoon, and I do that pretty much relentlessly. I do believe in writing every day, even if I sit down and there's nothing to write, or if I do my favorite thing to do, which is to not write and procrastinate. But yeah, I think, especially if you believe in inspiration and you believe in things like the muses and whatever, I think if you set up a routine, the muses will show up. I think you can dictate your creativity instead of the other way around. And also, I wrote my second novel when I was on tour for my first, so I can write pretty much anywhere. I can reel them off, Nina's, Coffee News, Humphrey Terminal, wherever, if I can open the laptop, I'll write. But I do believe that, though, if you're writing, that routine is important. And you can write in fits and starts, but you'll never finish a book that way. All right, we're done. Thank you guys for coming out. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Fireside Podcast, presented by the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. The next episode will feature William Swanson, author of Stolen from the Garden. Until then, we hope you consider supporting the Friends and its mission, stronger libraries for stronger communities. Learn more at thefriends.org. Follow us on Twitter @thefriends and on Facebook at facebook.com/friendsofsppl. Please consider subscribing to this podcast on iTunes.